Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 18th of June. I think this is Paul McCartney's 65th birthday, I believe. We have two terrific hours for you. Carl Bernstein is going to be joining us the first hour of our program today to discuss his brand new book, A Woman in Charge, about Hillary Clinton. The second hour of our show, Ken Rudin from National Public Radio, who's this wonderfully lively, very involved in everything political for National Public Radio and has a huge collection of political buttons, will be joining us for our All Things Political segment. And we'll be welcoming your phone calls as well. He says this early in the introduction, I think, to his book on Hillary. Imagine this, a sitting First Lady of the United States was going to the state of New York where she had never lived and run for the Senate while she was in the White House and pulled it off. Every political consultant in the world would say, preposterous, it's goofy. Where did that come from? And she did it. This is a very thorough, very even-handed treatment, I think, of her. And it looks extensively at her father, at her mother, at, of course, Bill Clinton, and as at her faith, at the values that really have formed her since she was in high school. Carl Bernstein is the winner of a Pulitzer Prize for coverage of Watergate for The Washington Post, the author, for those of you who are young in our audience, with Bob Woodward of All the President's Men and The Final Days. He's also the author of His Holiness, John Paul II and the History of Our Time. He's the author of Loyalties, which is a memoir about his parents during the McCarthy era. He's a contributing editor for Vanity Fair, writes for Time, USA Today, Rolling Stone, and The New Republic, and was Washington bureau chief and correspondent for ABC News. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. Hello, Carl. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be here.
It's such an even-handed treatment of her, too. I mean, she's a fascinating character, but she's so polarizing, and I think that you have, through the book, she's not as polarizing. I mean, we get a more complete picture of her, so I enjoyed it. I grew up about 5 miles from her, and she went to my dad's high school, so I've had this fascination with Clinton for a long time. And I found the early part of the book, you say that her marriage with Bill, the difficult but enduring marriage, more easily explained in the context of her childhood and the marriage of her parents. Would you start with that?
Her father was a very sour, unfulfilled man, a martinet, who humiliated verbally and abused his wife verbally. And it was a marriage that visitors to the Rodham home, many of them, including some of Hillary's girlfriends from childhood, wondered why her mother never left the marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And her mother, Dorothy Rodham, had a horror of a childhood herself, had been abandoned by her own parents when she was 3 years old. And in this household that her father ran like a boot camp, Hillary had to learn to fend for herself, and did. But what is so interesting in terms of her own marriage is that her mother counseled Hillary and Hillary's brothers, you do not get divorced in this family. You work it out.
Mm-hmm.
You try to get counseling if you have to. So that from early on, the notion of divorce was anathema to Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm. And very different politically as well. Her mother, a Democrat, you say, although probably nobody in Park Ridge, Illinois, knew that she was. Her father was a conservative Republican.
That's correct. Hillary is very much, she's described herself as a mind conservative and a heart liberal at one point when she was very young. She asked, is it possible to be a mind conservative and a heart liberal, she said, when she had gone off to college. And there certainly is something in that description that has remained with her all her life.
Mm-hmm. Aside from her family, you write, her Methodism is perhaps the most important foundation of her character. I don't think we dwell on that very much with Hillary. We don't realize the role of faith in her life.
Well, it's with family and faith are really the two cornerstones of Hillary Clinton's life, beginning in childhood. And she said the other day with a couple of the other candidates that she has never worn her faith, her Methodism, on her sleeve, and it's true. But she is intensely religious. The first person I talked to for this book when I began 8 years ago, someone extremely close to Hillary in her political life as well as personal life, said to me, to understand Hillary, first you have to understand her Methodism.
Hmm.
She believes and has since childhood in John Wesley's admonition to his followers to do all the good you can, everywhere you can, whenever you can. Hmm. And as the book notes, in following that precept, many people in the White House believed it gave a kind of purity of vision to her undertakings, and yet there were quite a few who believed that it gave her a self-righteousness and that she used religion as an excuse to cover up her own faults, to suspend some rules when and go by a theory of the ends justify the means, and to cover up character defects of her and her husband. Mm-hmm. So regardless of how you look at it, you need to understand. You're talking about somebody that carried a dog-eared copy of the Bible with her almost everywhere she went when she was in the White House, who in the first 4 weeks of being First Lady had joined a women's prayer group whose members included Susan Baker, the wife of James Baker, the Bush family consigliere, a woman named Leachman, who was a pastor herself, and whose husband was the pastor of the Washington Redskins, and presided over a church in McLean, Virginia, where Ken Starr, the special prosecutor, worshiped.
Hmm.
These women prayed with her and for her throughout her term in the White House, gave her spiritual axioms that she would carry with her. And she also has many brushes with New Age spiritualism. Marianne Williamson, the New Age guru, for lack of a better word, after Bill Clinton was reelected, Hillary had Marianne Williamson and Tony Williams, the self-help author, and a couple others, to a retreat to discuss the upcoming plans for the next 4 years of the presidency. She was obviously subject to influence by a woman named Jean Houston, who engaged her in these, not seances, they were mocked as seances, but on a couple of occasions would conduct kind of role-playing dialogues in which Eleanor Roosevelt, Mahatma Gandhi, and others were present.
Right, that would have been fun to be there.
Played. But whatever the case, you've got to understand how religious Hillary is and how she has depended on religion to get, as one person told me in the White House, this is how she got through the Lewinsky and impeachment business, was her faith. And she said that herself the other day.
It's
true.
Is it also problematic for her? You brought up the word self-righteous, and I think that Bill Bradley has used that word about her, that she, and I know you talked to some presidential aides who said...
Bradley encountered her and told me about this encounter in the third month of the Clinton presidency when she was addressing a group of Senate Democrats about health care. And he asked a question about wasn't she moving a little too fast given the schedule that they were already behind on, and shouldn't they maybe do a little rethinking of a couple parts of the program? And she turned to him and said, look, anybody in the Congress or anywhere else that slows down our train is going to be demonized.
Hmm.
And Bradley said to me that was it for me as far as Hillary Clinton was concerned, the self-righteousness, the disdain, I'm quoting him right now. You don't say that to U.S. senators if you're going to demonize them. And Pat Moynihan, whom she succeeded in the Senate, ironically, was also there, and he was the equally totally alienated by this for a long time.
And does some of that come from the religion? Does some of it come from the, I'm holier than thou, I can get through this because, you know, I'm right and you're wrong, I have the high road?
I don't know the answer. You know, I'm there are certainly many people around her who believe that. What I set out to do is 8 years ago, I knew that she might be running for the Senate from Illinois or from New York, that she was, it was a great story, what had happened to her in the White House that nobody really knew the inside of, and that, that if she was the only person who came out of impeachment and the Clinton presidency who hadn't been diminished by the Lewinsky ugliness. Not, you know, Bill Clinton, the Supreme Court, the press, the Congress, especially the Republicans in Congress, all had been diminished. Yet her stature was enhanced, and she was about to have a whole new life with a kind of independence that she had never had.
It's pretty amazing.
So I was fascinated and said, nobody understands this woman. Nobody really knows who she is, even though she's the best-known woman in the country. And she's going to be with us, and this is going to be a great story, and I want to follow it.
Yeah. Tell me about this guy, because it seems to me as though he was incredibly influential in having her look at the world another way, interpret her faith another way, and she's consulted with him many, many times, and that's this Methodist youth minister, Reverend Don Jones.
When Hillary was in 10th grade in Park Ridge, a youth minister, whom you've just named, came to her town and to her church. He arrived in a red 58 Chevy Impala convertible. He had Bob Dylan records with him, and he brought copies of E.E. Cummings' poetry and pictures, reproductions of Picasso's Guernica, the great painting depicting the agonies of the Spanish Civil War. And he showed these youngsters a Methodist faith that was informed by the beliefs of 20th century theologians like Niebuhr, Tillich, Bernhoeffer, in which the Gospels were interpreted with a message of a political message as well, that social service had to be fused with religion in such a way that there was a duty even to be political, to strive for public policy and participate again, back to Wesley's admonition, do all the good you can, etc., but with a faith that is infused by a solid philosophical slash political notion of action. And Hillary has said, that is why I'm comfortable in this church, this notion of Wesley's admonition and the idea that you have a duty as a Christian to help other people. Again, she also has said, is it possible, in a letter she wrote, is it possible to be a compassionate misanthrope? So we always get one side and then the other. And that's why doing this book was one, so fascinating in these 8 years. But I felt like I really got to see these two sides of her. And almost always, you know, and it's true of, I think, most people who have had big lives, big historic lives, and who have been in struggle with others and with themselves for most of their lives, that you get these two sides. And, you know, it's funny. Yesterday was the 35th anniversary of the Watergate break-in, so there's all this coverage in the paper about our early coverage of Watergate in the Washington Post. And one of the things that's been so humbling and gratifying about this experience have been the reviews, which of the book by the critics, you know, who really the best reviews that I've gotten since All the President's Men, some of them even better, and they have seen how this is a very different woman than either she presents or others have presented, because finally, as they put it, there is a definitive work on her life up through the present. And people will be adding to that record. But what's so important is that we're in a presidential election cycle, and this woman may well be the next president of the United States. And this is really a roadmap that, that helps people understand who she might be as president by explaining and showing who she has been in her life. And she has never wanted people to know who she has been in her life. Her autobiography, as she calls it, is just full of omissions and obfuscations. And she's had a camouflage life. And finally we're able to look at her without the camouflage here. And woe and behold, she's more interesting than she would have you be in her airbrushed treatment. She's more compelling. She's got some really sharp edges and elbows. She talks like a sailor and talks like a saint at different times. Mm-hmm. But she is so much more authentic and interesting than her public persona often makes her. And I think that one of the interesting reactions to the book appears to be her own reaction to the scrutiny of late that she's been under, and about this question of inauthenticity, because mm-hmm. there's no question, I raise it very seriously at the end of the book, that it's been very noticeable in her Senate years that she has not embraced with passion the positions that she once did. She's ducked an awful lot of great national issues, even though she's the only senator with a national constituency, and she's often robotic and has been mm-hmm. in this campaign. Last 6 weeks, 4 weeks, whether it's a coincidence or not, I'll say it is, she's really becoming much more passionate and authentic, if you will, out there. And I think it's one of the reasons, perhaps, that there is a spark of this authenticity that the numbers have changed in her favor in the last couple of weeks.
So why is it, though, that she spent so much time, Carl, presenting herself as less interesting than she really is? I mean, that's a key thing about your book. She is much more interesting than this plastic.
Well, but part of what makes it interesting is telling the truth.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And she is someone who has had, throughout her public life, real trouble with telling the truth, especially, you know, the whole contextual truth. And there are reasons that explain it at various points, not the least of which in the White House years is that she was being pursued by an out-of-control special prosecutor who wanted to indict her. And one of the things I write about is the aura of these White House years when she was terrorized that she was going to be indicted, as her lawyer, who was, you know, almost all of the major things in the book come from on-the-record accounts of the people who know her best, including one of her lawyers, Mark Fabiani, who said to me, "I cannot state strongly enough how real the threat of indictment was." And this was for 3 years or so. And imagine what it's like to come to Washington, as Harold Ickes told me, and think, you know, her principal advisor in the White House, and think you're coming here to do good, and all of a sudden you're under this kind of pressure, and somebody wants to indict you, and you, instead of being a great first lady, you're looking at going to court. You know, that's a hell of a thing to confront. So that, as her lawyer told me, she just decided not to be forthcoming, and with the special prosecutor and with the press. But she's done this often, and I would say that in terms of looking at somebody as a presidential candidate, particularly after 8 years of a kind of mendacity. By a president who has brought catastrophe to this country, George Bush, I think this question of her truthfulness is going to be a major one that voters look at, and she's going to have to explain.
Carl Bernstein is our guest, and his book is A Woman in Charge. It's about Hillary Clinton, and we're welcoming phone calls for him as well. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Well, of course, I have to move into the presidency, the Clinton presidency. He writes, when the definitive history of the Clinton journey is written, its Thucydides will be hard-pressed not to portray the White House years as a co-presidency. We'll talk about that with Carl Bernstein in a moment. And welcome your phone calls. Lines are open for you completely at this moment. I would imagine they'll get pretty full as we carry on. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, Ken Rudin will be joining us, political editor for National Public Radio. He writes the Political Junkie column, and he'll be with us to talk all things political, hour number two. Carl Bernstein is with us. His latest book is A Woman in Charge, he's a winner of a Pulitzer Prize for coverage of Watergate for the Washington Post, and is the author of All the President's Men and the Final Days and a number of other books as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. Before we go to phone calls, Carl, let's look at this the political partnership. She was, in every sense, you write, Bill Clinton's political partner, and this is from the get-go, the person with whom he discussed every significant matter of policy, strategy, ideology, or ambition. It's part of their great attraction for each other, I think.
Well, this is a real love affair. Part of this book is about this remarkable and unconventional love story that persists to this day, whatever others on the outside might think about the so-called dysfunction of the marriage. It's still a love affair. These people love each other, and I don't know a single person who knows the two of them that it doesn't believe that to this day. But go ahead with your question.
So talk about their meeting and their deciding that they were going to do all the good they could, you know, that you've quoted.
Well, I think that there's been much too much oversimplification. I mean, first of all, there's been some talk about a 20-year plan for her to become president, which is total nonsense.
Yeah.
And more than that, everybody who knew Bill Clinton well as a young man knew that he was probably the great political talent of his generation and was going to be, and that his political talent was limitless, and that he had political aspirations, and he wanted to go back to Arkansas. And from the time he was in college, people were saying that this guy might be the president of the United States someday. So certainly Hillary Clinton recognized that, too. What she also recognized, and I'm going to veer from your question and then come back to it, what she also recognized, though, very early in their relationship, was that his sexual compulsions, and she was the only one to realize this at first, would utterly derail and make him politically unviable if they became known and the effects of them and their acting out became part of the political record. So from very early, from the time he was governor, she began trying to contain and obscure and savage the women who were involved or alleged to be involved or came forward to say they were involved with her husband. And there's, you know, in the book, there is no salaciousness. There's only three women mentioned, one of whom, Marilyn Jo Jenkins, as I was told by Betsy Wright, and for the first time we now know, Betsy Wright being Bill Clinton's chief of staff in the governor's years, that he wanted to leave the marriage, to leave Hillary for another woman, Marilyn Jo Jenkins. And Hillary, as Betsy Wright told me, wouldn't give him a pass out of the marriage. But what's so significant, and what Betsy Wright talks about a good deal in my interviews with her, is this constant effort to cover up and intimidate, get statements from women that they didn't have affairs with Bill Clinton's. At one point, Hillary had her own law firm hired to represent five of the women in 1990 who might have it was inferred by some people had affairs with her husband. I don't necessarily believe that they did, but she hired her own law firm to represent the women and get statements from them that they didn't. She interrogated one of them herself. So there's this kind of intimidation that's constant, and then it's, you go back to her religion, She has forgiven Bill Clinton many times, but never the women. Which is understandably difficult, but she's gone out of her way to see that these women were both silenced and often savage.
Yeah.
So, but back to your question about their meeting and this idea of how she was there at every step of his political development, which of course she was. She Bill recognized that she had a kind of toughness that he didn't. He is a natural compromiser. She is not someone who comes naturally to compromise. She has a kind, as I write, a kind of military rigor. She reads the landscape, looks at impediments and potential enemies, and deals with them effectively. He is someone who thinks he can charm anyone, and she moves straight ahead and much faster than he does. And she learned how to really manage him politically. Mm-hmm. So that his talents and what she really dedicated her life, much of her life to, was allowing his unbelievable political talents and talents at governance to thrive. And when she went to Arkansas, she knew that she was giving up her own aspirations in many regards to do that, and it was a conscious decision, and she was willing to do it. Now, there's another factor that I discuss at some length. She had failed the D.C. bar exam, which she revealed in a one-sentence in her so-called autobiography, and it turns out, she, of course, she had kept that secret from her closest friends for 30 years.
She was really embarrassed about it, wasn't she?
Well, her closest friends who I talked to, Webb Hubble, who was her law partner, Nancy Bekovac, who was knew both Clintons from law school and whom they see every few weeks and talk to every few weeks. Jim Blair, the wife, the husband of her closest friend, Diane Blair, and Bill Clinton's great friend. Donna Shalala, Secretary of Health and Human Services, and her friend. No one knew that she had failed the bar exam in the District of Columbia. And they all surmised that, look, this was the greatest failure of her life. She had gone to Yale Law School, taken the D.C. bar. I went and got the records of the Bar Association exams for that year. She was almost 600 people passed it. A couple hundred failed. Now, many bright lawyers have failed bar exams the first time out, but she never took it again. She told people that she had been offered, for years, she's told people she was offered great jobs after law school by fancy Washington law firms, but of course she could only go on to work with them as a paralegal or answer the telephones or something unless she took the bar again, and she seemed to have no inclination to do that, took the Arkansas bar and passed, and she wrote very tellingly, I think, that perhaps my bar exam results were telling me something, and that I was heading toward Arkansas.
Toward Arkansas, Mary Bill.
But the idea that she never told anyone, and, you know, until health care, which was a similar shock to her, she had never failed on a huge scale. Remember, this is what she wanted to do with her life, she said.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you entertain the question, what if she had passed?
And, you know, I raise the question. I say, well, you know, you can speculate what the history, her history,
right,
and that of the country would have been had she passed. But you know, she didn't, and that was that.
That's it. Let's go to phone calls. Karen is our first caller from Minnesota. Hi, Karen.
Hi, I'm a Parkridge girl, too.
Are you really?
Really?
Yes. Oh.
Well, did you go to Maine High School?
I went to Maine High School.
What year?
I graduated in 1959, so I'm about 5 years older than Hillary Clinton. This is so revealing, this program. Very, very perceptive, I think. Here's something that may throw a little bit of light on things, too. I think even though maybe in Hillary's family growing up, she would have had some difficulties that I did not have in my family. I can remember any time there was any kind of an argument in our family, if it was in the summertime and the back screen door was open, my mother would say, "Close the door, girls, the neighbors will hear."
Hmm.
And I'm thinking Hillary probably was raised with very much a similar kind of attitude. And even though Betty Friedan wrote her book, The Feminine Mystique, in 1963, and many of us read it and were very influenced by it, you still carry with you things that you learned as you were growing up.
Well, Hillary has described herself as a transitional figure in regard to feminism. That is to say, she was not in the first wave of the Betty Friedan period of the feminine mystique, and she's always had sort of 1 foot rooted in feminism and 1 foot rooted in her mother's, the values of her mother's generation in many ways. This transitional notion. She's never been, and Betsy Wright, who was Bill's chief of staff, as I said, and who had actually first met Hillary and had gone to Washington after the McGovern campaign to work with the Women's National Political Caucus with the idea that Hillary might someday be the first president of the United States. Betsy saw that much talent and future for Hillary, though Hillary never really showed much interest in running for office. But one of the things Betsy Wright observed to me is that Hillary sometimes showed a kind of unawareness of the struggle, maybe because, said Betsy, Hillary seemed to have moved so fast and with comparative ease, or so Betsy thought. I don't think it was so easy, through struggles that other women had much more trouble with, that Hillary never gave much thought, Betsy Wright perceived, to some of the struggles that women had to go through, because mm-hmm. her own path was not as difficult. I'm not sure I subscribe to that, but it's an interesting observation.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's go next to Reed from Clintonville. Hi, Reed. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Hi.
Say, a couple of observations. One is Hillary seems to, the past decade or so, become really a very much a realist and a pragmatist. But my real question is whether or not Mr. Bernstein sees, due to Hillary's background, her history, whether or not she might appoint a rather unusual cabinet, including maybe a higher percentage of women, such as even a woman as a defense secretary.
Well, sure. I mean, she was insistent that Bill Clinton appoint more women to his cabinet. And that there be a woman attorney general, because there had never been a woman who had headed defense, justice, treasury, or commerce. And of course, she's going to would appoint more women. I don't think there's any question about that.
Go back to those Wellesley-Yale years for a moment, because that's a fascinating part of the book. And I had forgotten that she's picked by, what, Life magazine, is it, to be sort of this representative, this bright young star?
No, this is at Wellesley. She had given a famous commencement address, Senator Ed Brooke of Massachusetts, the first African-American senator, who she had campaigned for, actually, in Massachusetts while she was at Wellesley, was the commencement speaker. And you're talking about 1969. It's only exactly a year, almost, since Martin Luther King was assassinated. The riots that shook them and that burned American cities, Bobby Kennedy's assassination, and the war in Vietnam was the great issue of the age.
Mm-hmm.
And students, including Hillary, were intensely anti-war. And so that she was chosen to represent the students as the commencement speaker, as a kind of valedictorian. And when Brooke gave a rather desultory speech in which he was almost condescending and but didn't mention Martin Luther King and was patronizing about the civil rights movement and intense political involvement by students, Hillary gave an extemporaneous response that challenged him. And she became quite famous because Life magazine shortly after did a piece on students, on graduates who represented their generation. And given that speech, they picked her, and there's a picture of her that ran in Life magazine with her Coke bottle glasses. So early on, she had a kind of fame that, and she liked it. She mm-hmm. really liked that recognition. Mm-hmm. She's always liked recognition. Nothing wrong with that. And it followed her, both the Life magazine piece to college, to law school. She was well known as a result of that piece by the time she got to Yale Law School and was perceived as a future leader, certainly on a faster track right. at that point than Bill Clinton was.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go next to Christine from Minnesota. Hi, Christine.
Good morning.
Hi.
I'd like to know how much she had to do with Kennewick Man and...
With what?
With what? What?
The Kennewick Man, when he had been found and...
I'm not sure I know what you're speaking of.
What are you talking about, Christine? The what?
Kennewick Man, when they had found the skeleton.
Yeah, I'm not sure what...
I don't know what you're speaking
yeah,
of.
Yeah, let's go to Dave from Park Falls. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, hi. Mr. Bernstein, given what you've stated about Hillary... and this, I'm sure, I don't know if you talked about it yet, but the Rose Law Firm records that you said didn't exist, and they turned up, I guess, in her study in the White House.
She didn't say they didn't exist.
She didn't have them, and then they found them kind of right out in plain sight. So clearly, there was some misstatements there at the least. And the way she treated the, I guess, girlfriends of her husband, do you think she's electable, number one? And number two, would you vote for a woman who has behaved this way?
Do I think she's electable? I think she's electable depending on how she runs this campaign and how much she is willing to be open and embrace the truth, including the truth of her past, and explain certain things. Obviously, the Clinton campaign decided, they don't want people to read books like this. And it's a shame because the reviewers, many of them, find it sympathetic to her. They've all talked about how even-handed and balanced it is. I think people read the book, and many of them will think she's more qualified to be president than they had thought. Some will find things in it that will disqualify her in their view. They probably were already inclined to vote against her in the first place. But the notion is that now we've got a roadmap. Here we have this woman who may be the next president, who has lived a camouflaged life despite her being the most famous and visible woman of our time. And now we've got an opportunity through this book to see who she really is. Now, would I vote for her? It would depend on the circumstances of what she's done in the rest of the campaign. And again, I think the big question in my mind, and incidentally, the thing about the billing records your explanation is you need to read the book about it. They disappeared, and her explanation was not found credible, certainly by many people, and many people believe she wanted them to be disappeared. But of course, when they were found, what's so interesting is that they didn't show anything terribly condemning about her work for Whitewater or anything else. What they did show is her lawyer, Mark Fabiani, explained to me is that and other lawyers that worked for her, is they showed that what she had done at the Rose Law Firm had been a kind of small potatoes lawyering. A lot of it had been shuffled off to even lower lawyers in the chain than her. that she had been named one of the top 100 lawyers in America. Certainly there was no evidence that she was doing the kind of work that the top 100 lawyers in America did from those billing records. It was really nickel-dime, kind of crude lawyering, not the kind of high-minded work that she has always wanted to be dedicated to. So I think that, in some ways, is part of the significance of those records. But would I vote for? It's certainly possible, and it depends on how she conducts the campaign. But I have to say that I find that the response of the Clinton campaign to new books, including this one about Hillary, and their desire to see that the information in those books is not read by people in this country is certainly disturbing to me. Mm-hmm. That I would think they want all the information out there. I've got a certain track record in over 35 years. It's interesting. It's the 35th anniversary of Watergate break-in this week. Hillary Clinton figured in the impeachment investigation mm-hmm. of Nixon, and certainly they know, and they haven't challenged this book in terms of the accuracy of it in any way. What they have done is that they want it to go away. I find that disturbing, and so even though that's a bit personal, but I also see, among other things, if she were to become president, she would have more White House experience and understand the White House and the presidency better than any president in our history incoming. She knows, she was there for 8 years. We never had a vice president that knew everything about what the president did. Yet here we have someone who was, in essence, a co-president for part of that time.
We need to pause for a moment. Carl Bernstein is our guest. His book is A Woman in Charge, which has just been published, and we're welcoming phone calls for him at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. Dave, thanks very much for your call. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Carl Bernstein is our guest. Let's spend a few moments talking about race. You write in the book about her meeting Dr. Martin Luther King and her belief and determination from her teenage years onward that the tragedy of race in America must be made right. And it's part of what attracts her to Bill Clinton, that he's an unusually enlightened Southerner.
Let me back up, though, before I go to the discussion of race to finish my rather long-winded, you'll pardon me, answer to that gentleman's question about whether I would vote for Hillary Clinton. The other aspect of that are the things that Hillary Clinton believes in and Bill Clinton believes in. And there's no question that this would be a co-presidency. And that the way to find out what kind of president it might be is to look at their co-presidency. And one of the things is that Hillary and Bill Clinton, I think, have for the most part always stood for good things politically. The question has always been one of means and ends in her case, especially. And I think that's the troubling aspect, and this truth-telling aspect. Any reluctance that I have would probably go to that. And of late, she seems to be showing an awareness that maybe because these books are out there, maybe it's coincidence. She seems to be moving toward a kind of authenticity that she has been unwilling to display. Mm-hmm. So we'll have to keep watching.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to comment on the race issue before?
Well, Hillary Clinton, when this youth minister that we talked about earlier came to Park Ridge, Illinois, one of the things he did was take her and her other Sunday school classmates to hear Martin Luther King speak in Chicago, and she went a second time with her childhood friend who I interviewed, Betsy Ebeling, to hear Martin Luther King speak secretly. Her parents, I don't believe, knew that she had gone the second time. And this was a great influence. And also, in her senior year of high school, she transferred, or was transferred, from the largest all-white public school in the United States to a thoroughly integrated one. And so for the first time, she really had interaction with black people. And it was obvious to her and her system of values that this was a great tragedy in our history, race. And so that when she met Bill Clinton, this enlightened Southerner who had an ease with blacks that no white politician perhaps of our time has ever had, and who was committed to the idea of using the political system and his presidency after the Civil Rights Revolution to further make opportunities and deal with the effects of racism in this country and the history of what obviously is the great American tragedy, she was really attracted to this.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, the White House staff of Bill Clinton did not have nearly so many blacks on it as Hillary's, to the extent, and Hillary's chief of staff, Maggie Williams, is black. To the extent, though, that Hillary's staff half-jokingly referred to Bill's staff as the white males in the West Wing.
Let's go to more phone calls. Running short on time. Kate from Madison is next. Hi, Kate.
Hi. I read some excerpts from your book, and one of the things two questions. One of the things I gathered was that Bill has owed Hillary big time for his infidelities. In other words,
She has enabled him through her actions in dealing with the problems of other women and you know, giving a kind of connubial credence, is the term I use, to, you know, in the impression, look, if I can forgive him, certainly other women and other people ought to be able to. And in the Jennifer Flowers episode and in the Lewinsky episode, she saved him. There's no question about that, as well as these times when she contained what came to be called by Betsy Wright bimbo eruptions.
Right. What about this fatigue factor? What about this idea we've already had these people running the country for 8 years? We've had the Bushes for 8 years. Let's move on.
Well, I'm very surprised that there's not more reaction like that,
mm-hmm.
because if she were to win the presidency and then be reelected, it would be 28 years in a row of Bushes and Clintons.
Goodness.
In the White House. And then, of course, if Jeb Bush ran after that and won 8 years, it'd be 36, God forbid. But it does. It raises really important questions. And Nick Kristof in the New York Times, I urge people to go online and look up Nick Kristof's column on this of a couple months ago about whether the country really does want these two dynastic families to dominate our politics like this in a country of 300 million people. Now, is it fair that Hillary gets disqualified because of this dynastic question? I don't know. But it certainly seems to me ought to be something that people think about. But, you know, the other question is, well, who is going to be the Democratic nominee if it's not her? And certainly if she is nominated, then it seems to me that people who believe in the kind of things that she believes in terms of public policy and what government represents, and particularly what the Republicans have represented in the presidency of George Bush, which is going to carry over to whomever gets the Republican nomination, fairly or unfairly. And I think at that point people say, well, I guess, you know, better this than the alternative, but there is just something deeply disturbing, I think, about the idea that all our political system has been able to produce in this period is this kind of Capulet, and, whatever you want to call it,
mm-hmm.
this two-family politics. But in no way does that mean, though, that she's not qualified to be president. There are other things to judge her on that either make her qualified or unqualified.
Thank you, Carl, so much for being with us. Enjoyed the hour. Thanks.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Carl Bernstein, the book is A Woman in Charge, and it has just been published by Knopf, and I would say it's quite a fair-minded treatment of Hillary Clinton. And, of course, Carl Bernstein, very well-known, won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of Watergate for the Washington Post, the break-in 35 years ago. Can you believe that? Yesterday, winner of a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage with Bob Woodward. He's the author of All the President's Men and Final Days, and also of His Holiness, John Paul II and the History of Our Time, and Loyalties, a memoir about his parents during the McCarthy era. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Sharome Owens for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, and to you for all of your calls. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and then we'll continue. So stay with us.